You're listening to TalkZone.com. Internet Talk Radio.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air.
First and 10 Ravens. Ball at their 17. Give to Ray Rice. Big hole across the 20, 25, 30, 40. He might. He's across midfield. He could. Patriot 30. What's that to be? 15, 10, 5. Touchdown. Ray Rice.
83 yards for the touchdown.
Huge play for the Cardinal defense. Shotgun snap. Rodgers dropping back. In trouble. Rodgers hit. Ball came out. Cardinals have it. Dansby. He's going to score.
No.
Cardinals win. They're going to Orleans. Carlos Dansby took it away from Aaron Rodgers and took it to the house.
This is Wayne Larrabee with the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish, and the Pro Football Weekly staff. Coming up, our divisional playoff weekend edition of Pro Football Weekly.
What's next with the front office and coaching staffs in Seattle, in Oakland with the Washington Redskins, and can the Arizona Cardinals hang on to their key players after the season?
It's all just ahead on Pro Football Weekly.
Pro Football Weekly is on the air!
Along with the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkish, this is Wayne Larrabee. Welcome to our divisional round edition of Pro Football Weekly. The way we hear it features the editors and reporters of Pro Football Weekly. And this week we begin with executive editor Dan Arkish. Dan, the Seattle situation. In college football, basically what Pete Carroll did was beat the posse out of town. In pro football, what he did was become the newest head coach in the National Football League as he takes over the head coaching position at Seattle. Tell us about it.
Well, Wayne, he's really hit the streets running out there in Seattle, as you can expect. You know, he's a very frenetic, high-energy guy. And, you know, initially out there in Seattle, when all this news broke, there was a little bit of a backlash in favor of Jim Mora, you know, kind of maybe getting a raw deal. But Carroll's a very convincing guy. He had his introductory press conference. He was very personable and amiable and energetic. And now everybody's kind of fired up just like he is. But the big thing is bringing in a GM who supposedly is going to work in lockstep with Mora. And both of them will answer to CEO Todd Lewicki, who, interestingly, has kind of become the new power in Seattle.
Well, and Todd Lewicki is the guy who interests me. Paul Allen, of course, the owner, reported to be the wealthiest owner in the NFL, unfortunately battling serious illness and unable to give 100% attention. I'm sure he's watching very closely. And I wonder, Dan, if Lewicki has commented at all on why he thinks Pete Carroll will be any more than the mediocre NFL coach that he was in spite of his success at USC. Clearly, NFL and college, two very different deals.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, Carroll, in that press conference, went out of his way to say that, you know, the last time he was in the league, that was years ago, 15 years ago, and he's changed, and he's learned, and it really thinks that he can get it done now, and has been wanting to get back into the pro situation for a while, just waiting for the right opportunity. And Hub, I think he just convinced Lewicki, who, as much as anything, really wanted to get a buzz hire, because, you know, out there in Seattle, they're almost like an afterthought national media-wise.
And of course, Wayne, the right opportunity just happened to coincide with the potentially serious problems that USC is facing with the NCAA right now.
Oh, I'll tell you. Well, anyway, you know, one of the things about this, though, that Pete Carroll mentioned is the fact that in his previous two sojourns into the NFL, he really didn't have much control of the football operation. I guess he's going to have a little bit more this time around, Dan, even though they haven't hired the GM yet.
Yes, he's going to have a lot of power, but not all-encompassing power to the extent that Mike Holmgren had there before. The plan is for him to work very closely, shoulder to shoulder, with whoever the GM ends up being. And, you know, what they really want to do, Wayne, is make sure that on draft day, when they, when they're sitting around the table, there's no fist fights like apparently there used to be.
Hey, Dan, Omar Khan, the Pittsburgh Steelers director of football operations, Floyd Reese, now with the Patriots, formerly with the Titans, Mark Ross, the Giants director of college scouting, John Schneider, Packers director of football operations, they are on the short list, along with, Pat Kerwin, who was working at NFL.com. Any leads on who the front runner might be?
No, I would think that Kerwin, you know, who is a well-known crony of Carroll's, has to be, you know, in the mix in some capacity. I know that the media out there is really kind of touting Floyd Rees, and I kind of think that's a good thing because I like him. I think he's experienced, and, you know, there's no ego trip there. I think he'd be very content working in the film room and just making great picks.
Hey, Dan, I just spent the last two weekends in Arizona. The Cardinals have a lot. They do a lot of things really well. And one of the things they've done pretty well is kind of take these simmering contract situations, the impending free agency, the desire to be traded type of issues that we have talked about on this program months ago, and kind of put them onto the back burner and focused on the playoffs and making their run back to the Super Bowl. But after the playoffs are over, Carlos Dansby, who came up big in the desert against the Packers in the wild card playoff game, and Anquan Boldin, who was unable to play in the playoff game and is, from what I understand, pretty doubtful for this week as well. But nonetheless, these two players are keys on that team, and yet they both could be hitting the streets before long. Boldin wants to be traded. Dansby could be an unrestricted free agent. What's the story there?
Well, you know, starting with Boldin, I would have to think that considering how well they played against the Packers without him, again, I mean, I think there's like 6-1 without him. He's as good as gone. He'll be better off somewhere else, and if a team were to offer a number two like the Bears did last year for him, I think the Cardinals would jump at that, and I think he's going to be moving on. They've got Early Doucette and Steve Breston and a nice core there. Now, as far as Dansby goes, you know, really until that game, the playoff game where he was really excellent, he wasn't the game changer that, you know, for the money that he's looking for, you know, Patrick Willis-like. I mean, he's a very good player, but not an outstanding player, and I think that with what he's asking, he's much less of a priority than perhaps Darnell Dockett, who emerged as a really, you know, up-and-coming disruptive Pro Bowl tackle this year, and they want to make sure that he's happy going into the final year of his deal.
We'll be back with more Way We Hear It when this playoff edition of Pro Football Weekly continues. You are listening to our divisional playoff edition of Pro Football Weekly. We continue with The Way We Hear It and welcome in senior editor Mike Wilkening. Now, Mike, in Cincinnati, defensive coordinator Mike Zimmer has been named assistant coach of the year in the NFL, and they rewarded him with a new contract. Can you give us details?
Well, you know, Zimmer will be back. NFL.com has reported it's a 3-year deal, but he is back next year. And, you know, a very important thing for that defense. He's a guy that certainly has connected with that group, you know, led them to, you know, the 12th ranking in defense in 2008. They were fourth this year, and they certainly, you know, were kind of the engine that drove that division title push for Cincinnati. And, you know, they were able to strike a deal. Zimmer himself wasn't exactly confident that was going to happen, but the two sides were able to work something out, and now he's back at the helm of this defense for the foreseeable future.
Well, Mike, they had great success in spite of losing their best pass rusher, Antoine Odom, very early in the season, I think after week 4 or week 5. They did clearly start to struggle a little bit against the run when Ray Mauluga went down late in the season, but you got to believe getting those two players back, a young defense building on their success, that they're in a good position to improve even more.
I would agree, Hub, and I think they're very solid in the front seven. Physical, they certainly set a tone up there. Zimmer pointed to some more pass rush pressure as something that they want to get, and I think they're capable of doing that. And they're also very sound in the back end, too, that you've got two very good corners in Leon Hall and Jonathan Joseph, and their presence really allows the Bengals to do a lot of things up there. Those are two guys that can play man coverage against the very best receivers in the league. They're not going to make a lot of mistakes, and that just does wonders for a defense, and I think that was a real key to the success that unit had this year.
All right, now up in Cleveland, a few miles north of Cincinnati, you've got Mike Holmgren. He's going to keep Eric Mangini, and in between the two is going to be the GM, Tom Heckert. How will that all work out?
That remains to be seen, but from all accounts, and you know, Holmgren, Heckert, and Mangini meeting with the media, it seems like it's a relationship that will be able to work. Holmgren immediately started out by kind of talking about the fact that there, you know, this curiosity with regards to, you know, who'd be making the call and things like that. And Holmgren seemed to indicate that it would be a collaborative process, but he believed strongly in what, you know, in what Heckert and Mangini would do, you know, and that, you know, the decisions that the organization would make, as he said, quote, would, you know, that they would be making them. And I certainly think ideally, the best organizations, it's something where from the top down, there's agreement, everybody's on the same page. I think that's more than anything what the Browns are striving for in terms of just everybody being on the same page, no infighting, and good, consistent football decisions are made going forward.
All right, but here's the interesting piece, Mike. George Kokinas was Eric Mangini's hand-picked guy, his buddy. Their communication stopped the day Kokinas got to Cleveland. By 3 or 4 weeks later, they weren't talking anymore. Reports are that he wasn't even in the draft room on draft day. What did Eric Mangini promise Mike Holmgren to convince him that he's going to play nicer with the people around him?
Well, you know, again, he won him over in kind of the re-interview process, you know, last week. Convinced Holmgren that, you know, that he was the right guy for the job, convinced Holmgren that the progress that they had made at the end of last season, or this season, I should say, was significant, was something that they could go forward with and really build upon. I think it's going to be a different dynamic here. I think the presence of Holmgren ensures that. I think that, you know, I don't think we're going to see the same report sort of leaking out of the building with regards to that. I really tend to think that this is something that that is going to be able to work. And I think, again, having a strong presence at the top in Mike Holmgren, I think, is going to be the difference.
All right, down in Houston, another one of your teams, Mike. Rick Dennison takes over as the new offensive coordinator, replacing Kyle Shanahan. Any changes that you envision in the offense?
Not really. I think that, you know, what it's going to do is allow continuity in the running game. We know that, you know, the Houston offense has so many elements of what we've seen in those traditional Mike Shanahan-led offenses in Denver. You know, that kind of that one-cut zone blocking running game, that's going to continue on with Rick Dennison. And the passing game is going to continue to be Gary Kubiak's sort of domain. And what we saw last year was that this was a team that was able to pass the ball without the ability to really run it because of injuries at running back. They had some offensive line injuries as well. So I think what everybody kind of hopes is that Dennison oversees an improved running game this year, that they're able to mix in that potent passing game with a little bit more threat of the run. And if they get that, you know, certainly this is an offense we saw this year can certainly move the ball on anybody, even if it's a little bit limited in one area.
Mike, we've just got about 15, 20 seconds left, but I think what you just described, this is not one of those complete offensive coordinator jobs. This is where the head coach does it himself and the offensive coordinator helps out.
You know, it's something where it's certainly Kubiak's influence is on that offense. But Dennison, I think, is going to have a significant role. And I think, again, you've got all the parts kind of working together here. Everybody's going to be on the same page. I think that's the one thing I take away from this.
All right. Thank you very much, Senior Editor Mike Wilkening. More postseason news and notes coming up on Pro Football Weekly after these messages. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly. Along with the publisher and editor, Hub Arkish, I'm Wayne Larrivee. It's divisional playoff weekend of the NFL. A lot happening around the league, so we continue with the way we hear it. Associate editor Arthur Arkish joins us. Arthur, we talked about, you know, Pete Carroll going from USC out to Seattle now, but there was some other residual aspect of this USC situation. A part of it dealt with Jack Del Rio, the head coach down at Jacksonville. 3 years. $5 million a year left on his contract with Wayne Weaver. There were rumors that he was offered the USC job. He has since, as you mentioned, he's apparently denied them, right?
Yes, that's correct. The report was that USC had actually sent him a contract to be signed, and Del Rio came out and said that that's crazy. That would never happen without an interview. He flat out denied the report, and that's pretty much what we know. As far as that is concerned.
Arthur, is now, from the word from Jacksonville was, okay, they agreed that he would coach at least one more year at Jacksonville. What does that mean in light of the fact that he has 3 years left on his contract?
Well, what it means is that their owner, Wayne Weaver, absolutely expects to make the playoffs next year. So, essentially, he's put Del Rio in a position where he needs to obviously continue upgrading the roster and get them into the playoffs, or he... Obviously, after 2010, it's very tenuous as to what's going to happen with the collective bargaining agreement. So kind of it's 1 year at a time, but he needs to improve greatly upon where they're at now.
Well, and Arthur, the other interesting thing about this story is that clearly Wayne Weaver is less than thrilled about Jack Del Rio. He kept him because of the money, not because of the coach he thinks he is. And you're hearing different reports of how Del Rio continues to go out of his way to find ways off the field to basically anger the owner, not showing up at press conferences. I mean, it doesn't seem like this relationship's going to get any better soon, does it?
No, it doesn't, and it's a little puzzling. Right after their meeting on Tuesday, when Weaver did decide to keep Del Rio, they set up they had a press conference announced, and there were two chairs set up with the expectation of both Del Rio and Weaver participating in the press conference. Del Rio obviously decided that he wasn't ready to address the media, didn't show up at the press conference, and then didn't show up later for a pep rally, starting to rally the fans to try and, you know, buy season tickets for this upcoming season. So it's bizarre. He's not very well liked, in Jacksonville, and it seemed that it would have been a good opportunity for him to try and win back some of those critics, but he's known to be stubborn, and he's obviously continuing in that path.
Arthur, thank you very much. We'll talk to you possibly again next week. Associate Editor Dan Parr is also with us in studio. Dan, part of your beat is the Oakland Raiders. All right, as we tape this program, Tom Cable, the head coach of the Raiders, kind of hanging in the wind, but I guess he got a vote of confidence from the punter of all people, Golden Toe Award winner Shane Leckler.
That's right, Wayne. We spoke to Shane Leckler this week. Had an outstanding season, almost broke Sammy Braw's record for net punting average, and he was very adamant that Tom Cable should be back. It's clear that the players do want some continuity at head coach. They are tired of all the changes. But Al Davis, apparently, as we speak right now, is preparing to meet with Tom Cable today, and there's reports that this could be a two-day meeting, could carry over into the next day. So this is a process that's ongoing, and it's not clear just where it's headed right now.
Well, and, you know, I love the fact that Shane Leckler wants to speak up for his coach, but the bottom line is what this really is going to be about, Dan, is that Jamarcus Russell, for better or worse, was Al Davis's hand-picked guy, number one overall pick in the draft 3 years ago, gave him $42 million guaranteed up front, and Tom Cable has gone out of his way to embarrass both the young quarterback and the owner in terms of what he thinks of his ability.
Yeah, that's right. At the end of the season, Tom Cable basically said that the Raiders might have been a playoff team if it wasn't for Jamarcus Russell, a statement that did not sit well with Al Davis, and we heard he told him not to come out and say inflammatory things like that, and Cable went ahead and did it anyway. Now, Al Davis has not fired Tom Cable yet, so perhaps his relationship can be salvaged, but as you say, it's looking pretty unlikely after that whole scene.
Meanwhile, down in Miami, they're looking for a defensive coordinator. Who's the front runner?
It looks like Al Groh, the former Virginia head coach. A guy who has a history with Bill Parcells, having served on his staff in several stops earlier in his career. They fired Paul Pasqualoni earlier this week, and they've also interviewed the Steelers linebackers coach, Keith Butler. He's a guy who's on the radar. Tony Sperano is doing his due diligence, but from all indications, Al Groh is going to be the next man in there.
You know, Dan, everybody thought this return to Miami would be one and done for Jason Taylor. He was not the same player. He wasn't a bad player. I've heard some rumblings now that he would maybe like to come back for another year. They would consider bringing him back. And then there's the issue of Joey Porter, who was invisible the first half of the season and played pretty well the second half of the season. And we're hearing rumblings that he may not be back as well.
Yeah, they have some real hard decisions to make at linebacker. They have Jason Taylor and Joey Porter, two aging guys who are probably coming to the end. Jason Taylor is a guy who could be back, though, as you say. And then they have a young guy in Cameron Wake, an outside linebacker with a lot of potential, but probably not a guy ready for full-time duty yet. So they really might want to bridge the gap here and keep Taylor around for another year, maybe even keep Porter around, although they have a decision to make with his salary. It's not huge, but he's a guy who might be expendable if they feel Wake's ready for a little bit more involvement. And, of course, they could be spending a draft pick early on an outside linebacker as well. So it could be a very different-looking linebacking corps, potentially, depending on the decisions that are made here by Tony Sperano and Jeff Ireland and whoever comes in as the next defensive coordinator.
Associate Editor Dan Parr. Stay tuned. We've got more coming up. You are listening to a postseason edition of Pro Football Weekly. This is Wayne Larrabee with Hub Arkish. The divisional playoffs take center stage this weekend in the NFL. Saturday afternoon, two high-powered offenses take the field in the Louisiana Superdome as the Arizona Cardinals meet the top seed of the NFC, the New Orleans Saints. Dave Zorn has our preview.
After one of the most exciting NFL playoff games ever played, the Arizona Cardinals hit the road on a short week to battle the New Orleans Saints at the Superdome on Saturday. Both teams feature high-powered offenses. The Cardinals' offense is coming off a 6-touchdown performance against one of the best defenses in the NFL in a 51-45 overtime win over the Green Bay Packers. The Saints' offense has a lot of weapons as well. Drew Brees is one of the best passers in the league, leading one of the best offenses in the league, and it is something the Cardinals' defense is aware of, according to defensive end Bertrand Barry.
Everything starts with Drew Brees. I mean, he's playing at a very high level right now, and we have to make sure that we try to contain him as much as we can. We understand that they're going to make some plays here and there, but we have to try to limit the big plays down the field and try to get a lot of guys to the ball.
Cardinals coach Ken Whisenhunt says they'll have a tough task going against the crowd and the Saints defense.
They bring a lot of different looks at you. It's going to be hard because of the noise, so the big thing for us is going to be being on the same page, communicating, trying to make sure we can adjust to all their looks. They do a nice job.
Drew Brees has thrown for four straight 4,000-yard seasons, but has played in just three career playoff games, and he's 1-2 in them. Offensively, the Cardinals are still not sure about the availability of wide receiver Anquan Boldin. The Pro Bowl wide receiver missed last week's game against the Packers with a high ankle sprain and a knee sprain, but he hopes to be able to go this week. This game has all the makings of another shootout. Some are saying it could rival the Cardinals-Packers game last weekend. Arizona's no stranger to road playoff games, having won in the same round of playoffs last year against the Carolina Panthers. This is a different year and a different beast in the Saints. New Orleans had a week off to rest up for this round of the playoffs and has had a chance to heal, especially in the secondary. Either way, it's a big test for both teams trying to find a spot in the Super Bowl in Miami come February. Kickoff is set for around 4:30 Eastern time on Saturday. I'm Dave Zorn for Pro Football Weekly.
You know, and I've never seen a number one seed come into the playoffs on shakier ground than New Orleans Saints are. You know, they've lost three in a row. It really should have been five in a row. They got gifts from Atlanta and Washington. And with any other opponent, I'd say upset, no question about it. The problem I have with the Cardinals is those 45 points they gave up to the Packers, and this offense in New Orleans could be more prolific. I think a repeat of last week's wild card game with the Packers is not only possible, it seems likely.
You know, and again, I agree wholeheartedly. I think the problem for the Cardinals is, can they stop Drew Brees and the Saints? They could not, in the end, stop Aaron Rodgers and the Packers until the final play in overtime. But when you take a look at Drew Brees and that offense, yeah, you're right, Hub. This could be a shootout and of epic proportions, no question about it. The nightcap on Saturday features the top-seeded Indianapolis Colts hosting the Baltimore Ravens, and our preview is provided by Derek Schultz.
For the top-seeded Colts, the wait is almost over. And no, that's not just about the bye week. When Indy takes the field in Saturday night's divisional round against Baltimore, they'll be playing their first meaningful football game since a Week 14 victory against Denver over a month ago. Defensive star Dwight Freeney said that he and the rest of the team are chomping at the bit to get back out there.
This is the test-taking time at the end of the year where everything that you've done to get yourself to this point now is time to execute. And that's, you know, you got to be excited for that. And, you know, having that bitter taste from last year, and we get an opportunity to finally get to where we want to get to, back to that playoffs, what we're used to, and hopefully we can get a big win.
The Colts were widely criticized, especially by their own fan base, for how they decided to forego a chance at a perfect season to rest key players in the final 2 weeks of the regular season. However, the benefit of that decision is that they're expected to be about as healthy and rested as they've been all season. Key players battling injuries like Freeney, fellow defensive end Robert Mathis, defensive captain Gary Brackett, and breakout wide receiver Pierre Garçon are all expected to be ready to go on Saturday. Peyton Manning will be a week removed from locking up his NFL record fourth MVP, but number 18 knows that this vaunted Baltimore defense always presents a stiff challenge.
It's a great challenge playing against Ray Lewis. You can see how hard he prepares. The problem is, it's, you know, there's 10 other guys around him that I think are good players too. You know, those guys are solid up front. They are stingy against the run. So it's the whole defense that you have to worry about. But certainly playing against Lewis just presents a great challenge.
Under Peyton Manning, the Colts are winless coming out of a playoff bye at 0-3 with losses in 1999 to the Titans, in 2005 to the eventual Super Bowl champion Steelers, and then again in 2007 to the Chargers. So the Colts can buck that recent trend of one-and-dones and win their first postseason game since Super Bowl 41 in Miami 3 years ago. And they can accomplish that by beating the Baltimore Ravens for a second time this season. For Pro Football Weekly, I'm Derek Schultz.
You know, and not only is Derek reports of the Colts been one and done the last 2 years, but the fact is, in their last 9 playoff appearances, they've lost their first game 6 times. Now, this business of resting veterans was started by Tony Dungy. It wasn't Jim Caldwell's idea. It hasn't worked, and I don't understand why they continue to do it. That said, they're a much better football team than the Baltimore Ravens. As long as they don't let the Ravens get a 2-3 score lead like they did last week against New England, I think they'll be okay. If they can play on the lead, I expect Baltimore's in trouble here.
All right, Hub, coming up, we've got the Sunday playoff games when the divisional round edition of Pro Football Weekly continues. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly. The Sunday playoff games this weekend feature the Dallas Cowboys taking on the Minnesota Vikings in the Metrodome in Minneapolis. Justin Gard has the story.
The second seed in the NFC, Minnesota Vikings, host third seed Dallas Sunday afternoon in divisional round action. The Cowboys come in as the hottest team in football, according to many, after beating division foe Philadelphia in last weekend's wild card round. The Eagles game, the first playoff win for Dallas since 1996. One reason for the Cowboys' surge, Tony Romo, who has shaken off previous late-season failures to throw 11 touchdowns to just 2 interceptions the last 6 games. Over that span, Romo has posted a quarterback rating over 105 different times. One reason for Romo's success, according to Minnesota Vikings linebacker Chad Greenway, 3-step drops and a massive offensive line.
Yeah, a lot of big bodies up front, you know, biggest line we'll see, but you know, we just got to continue to play our game. You know, we're not going to change anything we do. We've seen big lines before, and we've been able to handle them. You know, just more about going out there and just playing hard and putting our best foot forward.
The Vikings come into Sunday's game rested off the bye and ready to start the second season with 40-year-old quarterback Brett Favre. In home games this season, Favre has led the Vikings to an 8-0 record with a passer rating of 118 in those contests. He's starting his 23rd playoff game on Sunday and his 4th against the Cowboys. Despite all his success in the postseason, Favre has never beaten Dallas, losing all 3 playoff meetings before in the 90s. Favre isn't convinced the playoff experience, positive or negative, will have an impact on Sunday.
Every game is different. Every situation, although very similar, is different in itself. And so I've been in the playoffs before, been first-round games, second-round games, against Dallas, against this team, against that, you know, we're your favorite, whatever. But none of that will help this week.
Another matchup to watch for this Sunday, a Vikings rushing defense that ranks 2nd in the regular season against a Cowboys offense that averaged almost 5 yards per carry. The last time these teams met in the playoffs, 1996, a 40-15 rout by Dallas. Brett Favre isn't quite Joe Namath, but he sees a different outcome this time.
Honestly, I see us sitting here next week having this press conference again. And if that doesn't happen, it'll be a shock.
Kickoff from Mall of America Field at the Metrodome Sunday is noon central. In Minneapolis, I'm Justin Gard for Pro Football Weekly.
You know, Wayne, of all the games this weekend, this one is the toughest for me. I mean, it's easy to analyze. There's a ton of great information here. But as far as handicapping it, I just don't know what to make of it. I don't want to be argumentative, Justin, but I think San Diego's 11-game win streak probably makes them the hottest team in the playoffs. But certainly, Cowboys are the hot team in the NFC. But Wayne, you know, I look at that streak and that New Orleans game, they were very impressive for 2.5, 3 quarters. They tried to give it back in the 4th quarter and didn't succeed. They were very unimpressive the week after in Washington, and then they had the 2 big wins over the Eagles. So yes, they've got some confidence. Yes, they've got some swagger. But the Vikings present something that the Eagles didn't. When you go in against Philadelphia, your defense usually doesn't even think much about defending the run. It's not usually an issue. With the Vikings, if you stack the tape away, take away Brett Favre in this passing game, Adrian Peterson will absolutely kill you. And so I think this is a very different test for the Cowboys than anything they've seen in this hot streak of the last 3-4 weeks.
One of the matchups that kind of intrigues me a little bit, Hub, is Minnesota, 8th through the air, 8th in passing offensive yards. Dallas, 20th against the pass defensively. So that's the matchup. That's Brett Favre, Sidney Rice, Percy Harvin in the receiving core of the Vikings against the Dallas Cowboys downfield. And, you know, in the Metrodome, most coaches tell me the thing about the Vikings in the Metrodome, the big advantage, it's not just the noise. It's the fact that on that surface, they're a much quicker, faster club than they are anywhere else.
Well, and the way that Dallas hopes to counter that, they've had at least 4 sacks in each of their last 4 games. And the real resurgence of this defense, DeMarcus Ware has been all world all year long. He has been for a couple of years now. But in the last few weeks, Anthony Spencer, that opposite outside rushback position, you know, this is a situation where he's become a factor. He's got 4 sacks, I believe, in their last 3 games. And so it's pressuring Brett Favre. Now, remember, Brian McKinney at left tackle actually got benched a couple of weeks ago. So, you know, again, fascinating matchups here, and a lot of this could come down to how much time the Vikings can give Brett Favre to find those targets.
Yeah, no question about it. And again, I think also the other thing is this. I know Minnesota's very good against the run. They've been number 1 against the run the previous 3 years to this one. Green Bay was number 1. Minnesota was number 2 this year. Dallas, I think, is going to come out, and they're going to try to run the football, and they've got the backs to do it.
They do, and the health of Pat Williams, who missed a couple games prior to the end of the season, is a big factor in that run defense also. Also, the health of Antoine Winfield will determine, you know, what they can really do with Miles Austin.
Coming up, the last of the divisional playoff games and the Handicapper's Corner, next on Pro Football Weekly. Welcome back to Pro Football Weekly. The divisional playoffs conclude with the second-seeded San Diego Chargers playing host to the New York Jets in the AFC. Our story is documented by Bart Pasterna.
Chinks in the armor were exposed, but the Jets advanced past the NFL's wildcard playoff round last week by sticking to the game plan versus the Bengals. That playbook will be revised to a certain extent against a well-rested Chargers team that's riding an 11-game winning streak into the postseason. For starters, New York's number one-ranked defense will be facing an offense that's earned its lightning bolt logo. The San Diego running game may not be ranked highly, but it has LT and the pesky Darren Sproles. And the passing game? How about the NBA front court of Gates, Jackson, and Floyd going up against the talented yet somewhat shorter Jets secondary for passes from all-pro quarterback Phillip Rivers?
You know where they're at their best, and they know where we're at our best, and you're smart with those guys and who you attack. But certainly, we're pretty confident in the guys we have from sideline to sideline and that we can go out and execute.
And yap it up, something Rivers likes to do while putting the juice in the Chargers' O. Jets coach Rex Ryan knows his defense may have to shut up as well as shut down the tournament-tested Rivers.
To be effective, you have to hit them and disrupt them, though. I really like this guy because he's a competitive guy. I'm sure he's a coach's kid. It looks like he is. I don't know if he is or not, but that's my story, and I'm sticking to it, all right?
Coachosaurus Rex is correct about Rivers' dad and says his team will work to correct problems experienced in the Cincy wildcard win, like iffy special teams coverage and lapses in the run D. And they have to play to their strengths, such as rushing the football with Jones and Green. X-Factor tight end Dustin Keller and company will be blocking a Chargers defense that recovered 11 of 24 forced fumbles in the regular season. Oh, Dustin.
I think we match up very well, especially with the type of offensive line that we have. And, you know, our offensive line compared to their defensive front, I think we have an advantage in the run game all game. And if they decide to do like Cincinnati did, just load up the box with 8 or 9 guys, well, then play action is going
to
kill him.
Confidence, thy name is Jets, but they'll need to be well grounded to short circuit the Chargers. For Pro Football Weekly, I'm Bart Pasterna.
Bart, thank you very much. And you know, Wayne, I think the story of this football game is, yeah, the Chargers ranked 31st running the football. LT is not the same player he once was, and they're going to try and do better than the 31st ranked running team in the NFL. But the bottom line is they're not going to change their stripes and suddenly run the ball to beat the Jets. The Jets defense, number one against the pass, has got to stop this San Diego offense. And in spite of the Jets ranking, I'm just not that confident, Wayne, that they can do it.
Yeah, and Darrell Revis can only cover one guy at a time. That's the other thing. But here's the thing that I look at. The Chargers 20th ranked run defense and the Jets, as you know, just a tremendous ground game in terms of pounding away. And I got a feeling that may be what the Jets try to do this weekend.
Well, I think they have to because it accomplishes two things. It plays to their strength and it gives them a chance to put points on the board. And it also keeps their defense off the field. It may be the number one ranked defense. They don't want to have to challenge those huge Charger receivers any more than they want to. So certainly that is the key for the Jets. You know, the other thing about this is I give the Jets all the credit in the world going into Cincinnati, winning a first round game, winning a wild card game. It's almost as if they validate the playoff appearance that some, including me, thought they might not have really earned when the Colts laid down for them. So you ask yourself the question, is that enough for them? This is a young team. They're not playoff tested. Will they not be quite as finely tuned this week as they were last week? I think Rex Ryan's done a great job, but he's a rookie head coach. San Diego has been here. They've knocked the Colts out one and done the last couple of years. So there's so much favoring the Chargers here in terms of experience that I'm not sure the stats are anything I want to get too hung up in.
Yeah, I think the Jets are stepping up in class from Cincinnati to San Diego. It's a big step up in class. Well, it's time for the Handicapper's Corner featuring Chuck Esposito, casino manager, race and sports for the Tropicana, Las Vegas.
Hey, Chuck, welcome in. And, you know, I'm intrigued by some of these numbers this week because I've noticed them moving but keep coming back to where they were. I think Dallas opened getting 3. It went to 2.5. And a lot of places I see it back to 3. I know that Baltimore, I think, has been between 6 and 7.5. They're at 6.5. Is that by virtue of extra action this week or just teams not really sure, or I should say players not really sure how these teams are going to perform?
Well, it's a combination of both, Hub. It's really value. If you can get, say, the Vikings -2.5, there's value there for the Viking players. You can get the Cowboys +3, there's value there for people who like the Cowboys. And as you alluded to, those numbers are all around key numbers, 3s and 7s, the same amount of points that you score when you kick a field goal or a touchdown. So it's all about value right now with the playoffs approaching week 2.
Do you get a sense after watching last week and particularly on the AFC side that sentiment can swing one way or the other to the underdogs or to the favorites?
It has a little bit. It's surprising, but you've seen a lot of action come in on the Jets being the underdog, and some action coming in on the Ravens too, especially a +7, which is a little surprising to me because I thought the NFC was wide open, but in the AFC you have two teams there, the two teams that had the bye, the Colts and the Chargers, were the team everybody expected to be there. Yet the betting public likes that value, and they have backed the underdog so far leading up to Sunday.
Hey, Chuck, real quickly, I don't think we've ever talked about totals before, but I'm guessing you had to set one on this Arizona-New Orleans game. What is it, about 75 or so?
Not quite that high, but after last week's performance between the Packers and the Cardinals, you're seeing a lot of money on the over, knowing both the Saints and Cardinals can score a lot of points. Of all the games, I think that has the potential to be a major shootout on Saturday.
Chuck, thank you very much. Chuck Esposito, our handicapper from the Tropicana Las Vegas. Stay tuned. Publisher's Pen is next on Pro Football Weekly. The Publisher's Pen with the publisher and editor of Pro Football Weekly, Hub Arkush. Hub?
Wayne, all kinds of great stuff in the NFL this weekend, coming off the wild card games. A lot of people believe that the divisional playoffs are the four best games of the season. I know I feel that way. I look forward to them. But I'm not sure how this week we can talk about any other story in big-time football but the defection of Pete Carroll from USC to the Seattle Seahawks, and then what USC did to find their next head coach. Now, as far as Pete Carroll, I don't fault him for wanting to go to the NFL, and he's getting more money to go to Seattle, about $2 million a year more than he was making at USC. He's got a five-year contract. God bless him. He earned that right. I don't understand why the Seahawks and Todd Lewicki, the president of the organization who hired him, think it's necessarily going to be any different this time than it was when he was the head coach of the Patriots, the head coach of the Jets. The bottom line is that his success in college is explainable. When you get better players than anybody else, when you bend the rules a little more than anybody else, you're probably going to have the best team, and he did for years. He's a good football coach, but he's not going to be able to do that in the NFL. It doesn't work that way, and so I am skeptical as to whether he's going to be any more successful in his third go-around as a head coach in the NFL than he was the first two, but at least I understand why he's making the move. What I don't understand is how a respectable institution like the University of Southern California can go to Tennessee and take Lane Kiffin. And an old friend, Jerry DiNardo, the ex-coach at LSU, and I thought he said it best when I heard him say on the radio, "I don't know why any parent would let their child go play for that clown." Lane Kiffin goes to Tennessee. He's there 14 months. His chief recruiter, Ed Ogeron, is going with him to USC. And the night that Kiffin took the job, they started calling all the Tennessee recruits trying to get him to go to USC. Is there no credibility left in college football? Shame on them.
Hub, it's all about the kids.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Hub. That'll do it for Pro Football Weekly this week. Special thanks to the Ravens and Cardinals Radio Networks. Randy Myers, our producer-engineer. Pro Football Weekly originates from the studios of Syndication Networks in Chicago, Illinois. Now for Hub Arkush and the Pro Football Weekly staff, this is Wayne Larrabee. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you next week on Pro Football Weekly.